Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Today, I got a couple of folks who are no stranger to our airwaves and no stranger to movement work and no stranger to trying to bring about better tomorrows for people in our community. The first is a host, a writer, an organizer, and an interviewer. His name is Jesse Strauss. We know him, we love him. And he is here with the one and only Walter Riley, who's a longtime civil rights attorney, labor organizer, political activist, whose work spans the civil rights movement to contemporary struggles for racial and economic justice. And we're going to go on and learn a lot about Walter because they have a new book out. Jesse and Walter got together, and they have a book that is The Civil Rights and Structural Attacks. Conversations with Walter Riley and the interview and edited by Jesse Strauss. So, fellas, welcome to the show and how y'all doing today?
Thank you so much for having us here. It's always a pleasure to join you, Davey.
Thank
Let me
you.
start off with you, Jesse. Interviewing somebody like Walter, I think, is important in more ways than I feel many can appreciate. I mean, first of all, it's good to have somebody with his wisdom and his tenure in the movements, share his wisdom. But we are also under attack, where a lot of things that we don't really own, if we don't physically own it, if we haven't done it ourselves, they can be tucked away in somebody's archives, they can be removed from somebody's platform, they can be rewritten, recontextualized, and distorted. And we're seeing that happen all over the place. And so, at a time when somebody like Walter Riley is considered a threat to the current administration because of his political outlook and what he wants to see us achieve, he can potentially be censored and removed. And so, I wanted to talk to you about that, why it was important for you to sit down with Walter, collaborate, and do this book, Jesse.
Absolutely. Thank you, Davey. I think the most important thing that I think about when I think about like what can we glean from Walter and obviously there's hundreds of pages in this book, so there's a lot there. But it's that Walter is a movement elder, but he's not only an archive. Walter has been involved in the civil rights movement. He's been involved in labor movements. He's been involved in the anti-Vietnam movement. He's been involved in movements beyond what most of us can fathom being a part of, because we think of movement people as people who participate in something and are remembered for that particular participation. Walter has an incredible historical memory of what he's been involved with, and we'll hear, I'm sure, a lot more from Walter in just a moment about some of those memories. But Walter also doesn't give up. Walter is, again, I said he's not just the archive. Walter is super active. He hasn't like handed in. He hasn't given up. He hasn't set down the work. Being able to sit down with Walter for so many hours and work toward understanding his approach to movement building helped me understand that movement building is a permanent task. And the reason that this book is important to me, and I think the reason that it's going to be important to a lot of people in our community, certainly in the Bay Area and also beyond, is understanding the nature of working in movement at one point and building slowly over time to engage in the lessons that we've learned in one point in movement building, building to the next, building to the next, building to the next. And certainly we're in this movement work to win. But
Yeah.
in the interim, we're in this movement to build the movement, and Walter's still doing it. So it's an honor to be a part of writing down some of his story and sharing that with our community.
No, much appreciated. And thank you for that, Jesse Strauss. Walter Riley, I see you so many places so often. You're like a fixture And then, reading the book, I was like, man, we can't take you for granted. And, first of all, I appreciate the work that you've done over the years. I did not realize the depth of your history until reading the book. So that's the first thing I want to say. But the second thing I want to ask you, are you surprised at the political moment we're in right now with everything that is going on? And especially since you and so many others have fought to not have us be at this particular moment of authoritarianism, fascism, overt, things that you probably had to deal with when you were growing up, to see it kind of circle back and rear its head in a new form and fashion.
Thank you, Davey, for having me on. I appreciate you and appreciate the work that you do. I've known you since, what, the late 80s. And thanks, Jesse, too. I'm approaching my 82nd birthday, starting my 83rd year on May 1st. I am not surprised. I can't say that I'm surprised. I can't say also that I expected it in the particular form it takes. I think we, my experience is that we live in a very oppressive, political, authoritarian society in many ways, and it takes on different forms at different times. The rise of Trump in this latest election and this particular administration, it's pretty outrageous that this country, of all these places that we've been as a community of people and as a community of values, that we end up with somebody in the presidency and all the other people in the White House. And a great part of our media institutions bowing down, aspects of our liberal society unable to appreciate the moment that we're in and make the necessary struggles to try and protect what victories we have had and to push forward with more. Knowing that we've lived in this place and knowing the origins of a lot of the senses that Americans, US citizens have about who we are, it's not surprising, but it was not expected at this moment. And I'd have to say, and I've said it at other times, particularly in 2016, that I was a lot more alarmed in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected. I felt a great deal of betrayal. I had been a revolutionary. I had been involved in the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s and revolutionary struggles in the 60s and in the 70s and organizing. And I felt a sense of betrayal, not so much from the right wing, but from the liberal establishment in 1980 that allowed this kind of development of the Reagan administration. And it started, of course, before that, but that he was in office and created a pattern of work and conduct on the part of institutions that were able to lead us to where we are today.
What was the portrayal?
The betrayal was betrayal of liberal democracy. Reagan had no pretense of developing and supporting liberal democracy, and the people who supported him and the spokespersons who are around today that laid the basis for the authoritarian regime of Trump and the authoritarian regimes that are developing in the rest of the world that are being supported by the US. I felt that we had been involved in a major movement around civil rights with attempts at structural changes. We had been involved in the Black Liberation Movement, and for a general term that we call it, that reached a pinnacle in the 60s with spokespersons and movements and organizations developing. The development of the anti-war movement of the late 60s and early 70s, the environmental movement, the massive liberal movement that attacked the structure of education and society. And we ended up with a Democratic Party that was not willing to fight for the values that we really wanted. And our organizational structures did not develop as well as we should have because we were caught in liberalism. And we ended up with a Ronald Reagan. We ended up from what we know historically from the Republican movement and the Democratic Party moving into the Republican Party, the same people that we work with, supporting a right winger who wanted to destroy our economic foundations for working people, for poor people, for
Right.
marginalized people, and laid the basis for developing the ideologies and theories and institutions that helped to build the racist repression that occurred in Central America and Latin America and the islands around us and the impact in the world. So that we end up with a Trump in 2016 and that we end up with the Trump in 2024, it's not surprising. I was not expecting it in this particular form.
You know, Walter, as you were talking, I'm thinking of a number of things that came across in your book. One of them, and I think you kind of alluded to this, and maybe Jesse kind of underscored this, is that the movement didn't end. It's evolving. It still goes on. And a lot of times people refer to the movement as, oh yeah, back then we did it, et cetera, et cetera. And so to me, hearing you talk, would part of the betrayal be that so many people felt like they arrived at a point and they didn't have to do anymore? You know, like, I got a job, we got a governor, we got a mayor in the city, you know, all these things are happening just as Reagan is coming into office, you know, maybe a few years before and definitely a few years after. But it just seems like just hearing people talk from particular generations, they mythologize, you know, a lot of what went on, and you talk about that in the book, and that can be a trap, to the point that we don't really study history. We're not very, we don't read, we don't really dig deep, and we just hold up a lot of symbols. And it seems like folks on the other side have been putting in work, learning our history and reimagining their future and executing that in a fashion that we're seeing today.
That's absolutely my view, Davey, that the other side has been loading up and preparing because they want to maintain this system of profit, this persist system of white supremacy, this system of degradation of the world that we live in. And those of us who have to fight and struggle and be part of the communities of struggle for change have to constantly being battled. We see many of those series. But one of the things that happen in this world, and I think it's part of the struggle of living with the economic powers, the social powers, the institutions that exist in the Western world right now, certainly, is that we don't always maintain the struggle and the analysis that's necessary, organizational work that's necessary to keep moving forward. And as you say, people got jobs. People who were in the anti-war movement, who wanted to say that we were not going to support oppression and exploitation of the rest of the world, had to go to work someplace or another. And the system that they fought was not the system that they idealized in the same way. My meaning that they want to see some change in the role that they played. A lot of the folks in the movement, the liberal movement, and which is also very important to maintain in the progressive movement, didn't make the analysis that there is a structural system that maintains this oppression, that maintains this exploitation, that maintains this degradation of human society and human beings. And people became a part of it. The 9 to 5 became
Would
what.
you say that, and Jesse, you could jump into this as well, you know, because you've been a movement guy yourself, so from different generations looking at this, the goal oftentimes in movements, and especially how you describe in the book, is to really transform society, to you know, you talk about structural change. And that sounds good, but really, Walter, I just want my PlayStation and I want comfort. And once I get the comfort, I'm good, you know, and that is a mindset. I don't know if that is a byproduct of Americanism, meaning we're sold the white picket fence and the, you know, the two-car garage type of thing, or if it's just human nature, like, man, I'm here. Roof over the head. I had some chicken this morning. What else is there? You know, you do that revolutionary stuff, and I see that far too often. Now, they might not say it to somebody like you or Jesse, you know, let's fight the power. But when I get home, man, I'm playing my PlayStation. And did we account for that? The fact that people just want comfort, and do we have to pivot at this point? And I'll close with this. The reason why I say that is even in the face of what we have right now, so many people are hinging on midterm elections. Like, we're going to vote our way out of this and we can go back to comfort. And I don't know if that's going to be the case, but that is something that is motivating a lot of people to, keep their hopes up.
You know, I want to jump in because a lot of the way that we talk about the current political moment, and I mean that whenever we are, you know, it was the current political moment in 2003 when Bush started the invasion of Iraq. Sure, it's the current political moment in 2016 when Trump gets elected the first time. We often talk about it and experience it as this particularly unique and horrific thing. And what we're trying to do, and just to be clear, we are living in particularly unique and horrific times, but many of these unique and horrific times were new in all of these eras. One of the things that I was most enthusiastic to do with this interview process, getting to know Walter and getting to write down some of these stories, is exploring like this Walter's historical memory, you know, getting involved in movement building in the 1950s in Durham, North Carolina. And one of the questions that I ask him, it's later on in the book, it's as we're beginning the concluding portion, is like, okay, of course, we've talked about this lifetime of engagement in all kinds of ways, but at this point, you know, you have this memory from the 1940s and the 1950s, and then we have these horrific moments that we're living through in every single decade since. What has been the failure and achievement of that? And I'm going to hand it over to Walter in just a moment, but a lot of Walter talked about was access to an experience of joy, particularly for Black people. And that access to joy, you know, I wonder what the relationship that that has to engagement in struggle, but it's also a win in and of itself. So I want to hand that over to Walter. But that's a big part of why we engaged in this interview process, in this book process. It's like, yes, this historical moment right now is particularly unique and challenging and horrific. But like, what does movement work, even if we're not achieving full-scale revolution in a particular moment? What can movement work build us through over time?
I see that our experiences have helped to build a better world for us and a better world that impacts people all over. This is a particular moment. There's been particular areas of concessions being made, and people wanting to do their play machine. I used to talk about cran apple juice, that we needed somehow or another cran apple juice. When we had apples and cranberries and everything else, it's just an aspect of sort of jokingly decadence in American society that we can focus on building cran apple juice, and when we have so many other things that we should be involved with. But I see the history of the world as one of people building better lives, better worlds for themselves, and better futures. And I think that's largely what has happened. We started, if we just start with the recent histories of the transatlantic slave trade and what happened, how that developed, the struggle has been for changing the societies that built the transatlantic slave trade, that built the slavery system, and that built the oppression, economic, social, political oppression that resulted from it. And that's been constant change all along. I mean, we have periods of change from chattel slavery in the US to non-chattel slavery, and masses of people began to have some sense of identity. Part of the thing you mentioned earlier, Davey, is that things can be forgotten, the terms that you use. A lot of discussion today has to do with erasure. And if we don't remember what we went through as a people, black, white, Native Americans, immigrants of other nationalities in this country, and how working people and people at the margins had to make changes in their lives, then we start remembering myths about who we were and what we were and what happened, and what we are today gets defined based upon those myths. But it was a period of struggle and people building lives for themselves and finding the ability to build families, trying to be something more than the captured folks and the captured cultures and the destroyed histories. So I'd say, don't get at this moment to Jess's discussions about joy, but I do want to emphasize that my approach and my belief in the people I try and work with, try to develop some sense of we're moving forward constantly. In this world, and we're playing a role in that struggle in the United States, and African descendants of slavery in this country has made great contributions to the world in every aspect we can think of. But in particular, we can talk about the need for the world to understand the political struggles that we have given leadership to, the theories, the development of philosophies. Work and organization that we've given leadership to that will liberate us eventually from the oppression that exists here and the economic, political elitism around the world, their authoritarianism. I see that, and I believe that happens. I think that not just a belief, but there is evidence, empirical evidence, about how we can describe what is happening, how we're moving forward. But there's always moving forward and moving backwards, and sometimes seem static. But it is not static. American history is not static. World history is not static. There's always change. And right now, we're in a period of having to understand the nature of authoritarianism as it grows here, the nature of authoritarianism as our society has found its level of comfort, and the level of authoritarianism that is getting tremendous amount of resistance. There's a lot of growth here. And what I'm hoping that happens in this period, and particularly in this year, that there's more discussions about how we develop the solidarity in the movement. I'm interested in how this discussion about this book can play a role. I was surprised that Jesse saw me as somebody to interview, and I was surprised at his approach. And so I am enthusiastic that we should have this discussion. Whatever contribution can be made through this, I think, comes
Well,
from this. Trying to find out how we develop movement, how we develop change, how we identify where we've been and where we have to go.
the book definitely had a lot of jewels and gems, which goes back to my initial point that it's important to have this because it ain't going to be in a classroom anytime soon. It's not going to be on legacy media anytime soon where we can flesh this out and really dig deep and just sit with it. And a couple of things come to mind as you were talking, Walter. Walter Riley is our guest, along with Jesse Strauss, talking about their new book. Your upbringing in Durham, North Carolina, can you share with us some of the lessons you learned? And in particular, I'm looking at the fact that you're living in a place that you're basically sharecroppers. You're dealing with fascism in ways that many people could only imagine at a certain point in time, you know, that type of thing. And what stood out to me was this understanding of organizing is really sitting at the kitchen table and constantly just building with people, community, versus somebody just coming up and telling you know, I'm the new Martin Luther King. I'm the famous guy that's going to lead us. And I think that's a lesson that's been lost for a variety of reasons. But from your standpoint, what important lessons do you think we need to embrace from your time in Durham and maybe even share with our audience some of the challenges that you had in a place like that, from dealing with the sharecropping system to having to leave because of your, you know, the person you married?
Yeah. Well, to be clear, I grew up in a community in Durham, named Bragg-Town after the racist Confederate general. And there's been this, that name came later, but there are many other aspects of this system, representations of system of slavery, enslavement in that neighborhood. What's important, I think I learned, became aware of later, appreciated that I lived in a village. My father and mother stopped farming in about 1950. My father continued to do some of the work, but he became a construction laborer in around 1950. And but before that, since they were teenagers, married in their teens and having children in their middle teens, they worked tenant farming, sharecropping. Tenant farming, it's called in North Carolina, where somebody owned the farm, owned the land, and on the benefits of their labor, and basically gave them subsistence, economic support, where other owners gained everything. And most of the owners of those at that time were people who gained their property during the slavery period. And the names of the people that were the farm owners that they worked for at various times, sharecroppers, tenant farmers tend to move around a lot, just like tenants do in Oakland.
Right, but it's important to note that enslavement was within eyesight for many people living at that time, meaning that they had a grandfather, a grandmother, so you had relatives that were within eyesight. So it wasn't some far off foreign thing. And these slave, you know, these descendants of slave owners were the, you know, they could look and say, oh, my great grandfather owned your grandfather. I can't imagine what that must be like, you know, because you're right close to it. There are people that can tell you stories about all that stuff and vice versa.
I mean, there were people around. I mean, I was born in 1944. So, the Civil War ended in 65, 1865. So that was less than 100 years before that. There were people around who had real experiences with it, having been born into enslavement. There were others who grew up in households where their parents and uncles and some of the even the older brothers were enslaved at various times. So they had a constant history of that. There were people in my family who deserted their farm lands and joined the Civil War struggle against the Confederacy. Some of those names are on the walls. But these were farmers. These were people who said we couldn't live with that. So that was part of the history of all of us. One of the aspects of growing up, though, in the South is that we also had this attempt at erasure again about what our history was. Consistent approach that still is very developed today, even more than it was, let's say, in 1950 or 1960. The idea of erasing who we were and giving us histories that, through education, through school systems, that we and then couldn't necessarily see ourselves in, and that was part of the struggle for change. When I was growing up, I lived not far from a couple of miles from where my great grandmother had been enslaved in a slave cabin. And I didn't know her, but my older brothers and sisters actually knew her. Because she lived a very long time and they got to know her. I never knew any of my grandfathers, but I knew other people in the neighborhood that understood slavery. The neighborhood I grew up in had, from the 50s, from 1950 on, had the neighborhood had buildings that people were enslaved in. The house that I was born in was built by slaves and dwelt in by slaves. My family lived in those slave dwellings for decades. So
Did
when
you did that weigh on you? Was that something that was present? Like you think back and it, like it weighed heavy? Let me give an example. In hip hop, one of the early places that had parties was the Audubon Ballroom. And I remember we would go there and it was something about it. It's like, this is where Malcolm was killed, you know, and There are people, people that knew him and stuff like that when growing up. And it just, it was just something about the energy. And that was just a leader that we all know and love who was, unfortunately taken from us. But to be in a place where folks were enslaved, how did that weigh on you?
I think it weighed on different people different ways. Some people in some communities, there's a desire to escape from that memory because we haven't learned to appreciate our experience and learn from it and see it as something that we can build on. Just as for a lot of African Americans, we tended to not want to identify with Africa until it became a part of our movement. And still today, there are folks who don't want to do that. We have whole countries that don't want to identify with their. But that was part. But my family and my grandfathers had been organizers and activists in fighting against slavery. I still knew my father's mother, who was so proud of her father and her mother, who had been resistant to enslavement. And had played various roles in their relatives who went off to fight in on the Union side, but I could not go to the yard of my great grandmother's enslaved building even as a child, whereas other members of my family could. So it infected me that way, and it still do when I think about it. I visualize it every time I think about that place. I visualize that log cabin. Where she was, and I would look at it from a distance because I could go to a place where we were standing up high when I was a kid. And I knew that. I didn't understand even as a 5-year-old what it was, but as a 5-year-old, I couldn't go into that.
You can feel that energy.
I could feel the
Jesse,
energy of the neighborhood, yeah.
you wanted to say something. Jesse Strouth are the guests.
Yeah, thank you, Davey. I mean, I just wanted to mention like there has been a massive process of erasure, particularly of Black freedom struggle. But when we're looking back in the area that Walter grew up in, there's a particular historical memory baked into the geography of white supremacy. And I mean, I haven't spent as much time nearly as Walter in the Deep South, but it seems like a point of pride. Like the one piece I wanted to draw out, when Walter was a kid, he did day labor on a farm that was owned by a family whose last name was Mangum. This family in that area was a slave, formerly a slave owning family. As I did some research and was trying to understand the dynamic there, I learned that not only, of course, was that family a landowner when Walter was a kid, that Walter was working their land, but they became a political family with a member of their family in the US Senate. There was a member of their family that became the Durham County Sheriff. And that memory is that family legacy is still ongoing. I saw
Didn't
that
one go on to be a governor too?
Definitely. But even in 2023, there was a member of that family who was recognized by the Durham Police Department as Employee of the Month. The current city's jails, one of the current city's jails, resides on South Mangum Street. So, like when we're talking about historical erasure and historical memory, we're specifically talking about the Black experience and the movement experience, and the abolitionist experience that has transformed this world. That society is of white supremacy that led is still so baked into our daily reality. It's the same family from when Walter was a kid, when his I don't know how many generations back were on that same land, and it's the same family now.
They're still there. They're there, and they're still in power. So that struggle continues to define ourselves within that history, that we were resistant to enslavement. We were actively engaged in trying to build a sense of power and self-identification among ourselves. And that was part of what was happening in my community. And that's why my community gave me a lot of support, even without understanding every aspect. of the civil rights movement, the things that we're engaged in. My family, my community, a large part of the place I grew up were family members also from way back.
Right. But the thing that stands out to me in the book is the fact that you started becoming a leader, and talk a little bit about that, because I think when we say leader, we attach it to celebrity, influencer, and all that. And I think your philosophy around that is very different and something that we can learn from. But you were very visible in resisting. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And then at 19, sitting down with Malcolm X and what's the other brother's name? Floyd McKissick. So these were luminaries, and you're like still a teenager, So what, talk about leadership in that regards, and also baked into that, what I'm getting from you is that this is not a turn the other cheek type of scenario. Like, it's an option to do that. It's a practicality if needed. But I think we often romanticize about the South and kind of like, these were folks that kind of shuffled along and just took it versus, folks pretty much actively resist. And, well, I'll let you have the floor and tackle that for us.
Well, there was a level of resistance, and there was a level of resistance in my family, and it was part of my family. My dad, my mother, their parents were part of the resistance to slavery. They were part of resistance to supremacy, and trying to build sense of family and community. They were all part of that. That's part of our history.
Right, but didn't your pops like confront a sheriff with a shotgun? I know I read that, right? Yeah, okay. Don't glee, don't skip over
Well, you talk about
it.
leadership. I mean, I understand the importance of individuals playing a role and playing and moving out and offering their experience and their abilities, their resources to help things move forward. I've tried in my lifetime to not buy into the special individual being the leader and having importance. And I think it's important in terms of building movement. And I see that as a long arc, both for myself, my family, and the people around me. And it may not look like it's happening, but I think it d develops a deeper ability for people to p contribute to them, to their families, and to their communities. The story about my father. I got married when I was in high school. It was a very heady period. I know there are young people around that have those kinds of headiness today about what's happening with them, and they have pregnancies and experiences. And the movement, for me, we didn't, a lot of us didn't expect we were going to live very long in that period, rightly or wrongly. But we looked at the nature of the world we live in, and so we were prepared to challenge it and to offer whatever was necessary. But I got married because I married a woman who was in the civil rights movement, who had been a freedom rider, who was at Parchman Prison. She was from the Bay Area. That's how I'm out here right now. And a white woman in the segregated system in the South, that we got together against the laws and rules of God and man. We were not supposed to get together, but we did, and we lived in my family's home. One time, a couple of sheriffs parked out on the road down across from our driveway, and my dad said, my name was Cootie. He said, "Cootie, get your gun." And lots of folks had guns
Right.
and still do in the South. And I had a single shot rifle, and my dad got his shotgun, and he went out to the end of the driveway and said, "Get out of that motherfucking car," or something to that effect. "I'll blow your head off," or And he was from a family of fighters. They liked each other, his family and his brothers. They supported each other. And people who understand the nature of families here, or the nature of families even in the South, people who worked hard all of their lives, they didn't take crap. While they were not able to end the system of slavery and even plantation ownership, they had a sense of dignity. They had a sense of themselves, and they fought for themselves. And that was throughout slavery and afterwards. and it still exists today for a lot of folks. While we were fighting certain bourgeois ideas, black acceptance, there's still this sense of self that exists in lots of families and lots of communities in the South, and
I
even
think
my dad.
that sort of resistance, armed resistance, and we've done tons of shows on that, especially out of North Carolina, where the Williams family comes from and Mabel Williams and all that. So there's a
Wonderful.
history that, but the thing that kind of stands out for me with respect to that is twofold. One, armed resistance is on the table. And I think that's incredibly important because, as pointed out in the book, and as we see in real life, there's a sanitizing of the freedom struggle, the Black freedom struggle. So it's we're in churches singing, which we did. We're out marching, which we did. We're wearing our Sunday best, which we did. But all of these are tactics because even King himself, was strapped, to protect the family if need be. But the other thing that I think is important is you break down how some people saw these movements and they named it differently. So if we talk about, you say that when people were sitting in lunch counters and trying to, go against this Jim Crow system, it was a strike. I forget the word that you, an attack on the system, that's the word you use. But there was also a wording that you had, like there are some people that want to integrate and you wanted to desegregate. And I think this is real important in terms of the mindset of understanding and being clear what the goal is, because when we talk today, it's like, well, we get to sit on the back of the bus. That wasn't really the goal to sit on the front of the bus. This whole thing about desegregation, well, I'll let you break it down. I thought it was fascinating and an important jewel to really soak up.
It's important to think about what it means today. It was important in the 60s in the movement, determining where we're going and developing an idea of what we were as builders of movements and offering political leadership and theoretical leadership. I was at a meeting this weekend where Charisse Burden-Stelly made a statement that really struck with me. She says that we would not, without the civil rights movement, there would not be a black liberation movement. Without the civil rights movement, there wouldn't, and without the black liberation movement, there would not have been the further developments of struggle for us here. And that's different from a lot of folks who analyze what the civil rights movement was. One aspect of American society is that we're being erased for our political leadership and struggle. And there are folks who want to believe that that movement was all about integration, all about being part of white America and giving up our sense of self. And that is, in my estimate, I think I have to respect the folks who are engaged in that discussion, but they need to learn something more about who they are and what the movement was. They've forgotten something. What we were doing was attacking a system. We were attacking a structure of the American system, that structure of white supremacy that had, as part of that structure, the separation of our economics, the separation of our society that made it impossible for us to be able to legally sit where we wanted to sit, or whether it's on the bus or at a lunch counter or walk on the streets. And as young people, we were not ready to accept that. And we fought that. We were not trying to sit with white folks. We were trying to assert our own dignity. And we were saying the society we lived in, that our families had been a part of, that our families had fought for against the slavery system and with the Union, that our families had fought for and our communities had fought for in World War I. And my community had a lot of people, a lot of history that suffered from that. World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, as it was developing, trying to develop a society where we were whole citizens, where we had a part to participate, and we had a role and identity for ourselves. And I'm ex exercised about it when I hear people say that civil rights movement was just folks trying to be in the white community.
Or even worse, I ain't your grandfather or grandmother's civil rights movement. I'm like, Whoa, like you don't really understand.
You don't have the
Because
character.
I don't have the courage that you all had. I certainly don't. You know, that's why I said salute to you all, you know, because that is, you know, just to pick up a sheriff and face off against the sheriff and your father go bring your shotgun because this is what we're about that for real is not something that people readily do. You know, we'll pick up a camera and film, you know, and talk about it, but we ain't rolling up. And I've run into too many people who are from places like where you are from in the South, who really have that, you know, dignity that they want to keep intact and that sense of righteous injustice. You know, I think I would use the there's a certain righteousness that they bring to the table. And a fire in the belly that I think is that's been erased and sanitized and redirected. And so I think that's important to remind people of. Meeting Malcolm and Floyd, what was that about? And what did you glean from them?
Well, f with Floyd McKissick, because I was involved in the movement, because I had a family that gave me support in the movement, and it was from a big family, made it easier for me to work with lots of folks. I did play a leading role in the movement. By the time I was 14, I was playing a leadership role.
Now, Floyd is with CORE or with
Floyd
NAA.
McKissick is a lawyer in Durham, but he started out with the NAA.
Okay.
And then he became chair of CORE and became a very active national leader as a lawyer. And one of the reasons that I became a lawyer is because I worked with him. I had a desk in his office very early age because I was playing a leading role. Durham was the most active chapter in the country. Received recognition from the NAACP in 1962 as the most active chapter in that period for a number of years at the Atlanta Convention. But Durham and that chapter was a chapter of not the black middle class. It was a chapter of black working people, factory workers, children, farmers, and myself coming from a rural community. And one of the struggles that we have in our country today within the Black history discussions is that working class Black folk don't get the recognition for the struggles that they've engaged in. And we have people, historians, who try and bring that to light a lot more, but it's not part of the mainstream struggle, and it's certainly not part of the legacy media to recognize that, and it's not recognized clearly enough in the history of the black museums. But you have people like Robin Kelly, who will talk about that. We know him in the whole, and we have many others. Barbara Ransby is one of the people who has done some of that, other historians. But that was part, and that still is part of the struggle. Floyd McKissick himself was a person who fought for and organized and helped to lead direct action movement. Medgar Evers was a person who organized around direct action. And the people who were playing a major role around direct action, you've interviewed the folks, the Williamson from Monroe and others, but there are many other aspects of people and communities. The folks who were leading direct action and wanting to make structural changes in the world around them are not recognized enough in American history. And so we don't have the representatives being talked about and understood enough, particularly because black folk go to educational institutions and they learn crap. And they come out and they spread it very often. And we find that as something that people find it difficult to say. But we can talk about it from the national political arena to the local areas that we find that, and that still is a part of our struggle. And it's part of the struggle that we hear and that you are engaged in around these issues all the time. Who are we
No, I
talking? Where are we going with it? So, Floyd McKissick and Malcolm X had a discussion. The media wanted to build it as a debate between them around different philosophies. And I was the mediator. I mean, not the media, moderator. I was the moderator. I was a 19-year-old kid. And but because I was in the movement and had been organizing around the state, and I was in the movement, and I was the moderator between to set the framework for the discussion and make a statement in introducing the various folks. So I spent time with Malcolm X. I had spent many, many days and hours working with Floyd McKissick over that period of time. But they asked me to sit with Malcolm X, and I did. And we walked, he didn't walk picket line, but he went with me to walk picket line. And he
So,
stood with me. He stood with me while I picketed. And we had great conversations walking down the streets in Durham, North Carolina, where, black people could be attacked at any time with impunity. But people knew to some extent that we fought back. I was attacked with other folks on picket lines more than once, and I can tell you that we fought back.
Well, this leads me to another question, and I want to bring Jesse in afterwards. So you work with Floyd, you knew Malcolm, you shook hands with a lot of people. Why the Progressive Labor Party? Why not the Nation of Islam? Why not be a permanent member of CORE? Why not SNCC, right? Where, there's a lot of folks doing actions all around the country. Why the Progressive Labor Party? Does Walter Riley break bread there? And as you say in your chapter, it's your political home. And why weren't you, Walter X?
Yeah, well, it's a question that would take some response with more time. But I grew up in the movement of fighting to make change. I wasn't fighting to build something for myself, or I wasn't fighting for economic position. I was fighting for social, a strategic change, and I wanted to see strategic changes in the nature of systems. That's why we call the civil rights and structural attacks. I wanted a change in the system. I wasn't all that clear about what it was, but meeting Malcolm helped me to understand it a lot more. Himself left the nation. I did not see the nation as making structural change. I saw the nation as making some political changes in our community and to help people to change themselves, to reform. And I don't want to spend my time talking about this book and criticizing others immediately, because I do want people to be able to hear what I say. I think it's a part of organizing. But I didn't see the nation as making the structural changes in our society that I saw in it. So I didn't become part of that. I was much more supportive and understanding of Malcolm when he left the nation, and I was part of building the first organization of support for Malcolm X that brought Sister Betty Chavez out here after Malcolm was killed. I didn't join the SNCC group because perhaps I didn't know enough. I didn't understand enough. I think that one of the aspects of a lot of us in the movement is, and still part of my problem, is that I do a lot of work and don't spend as much time building the intellectual environment that would be helpful. I do support building the intellectual environment, but I saw SNCC as a group of young preachers.
Well, we're talking, early
it
60s,
was
right?
it was it was out of the SCLC. And
So we should be clear, 'cause when you meet Malcolm, it's 1963. So we're talking about early, 'cause there's definitely a change,
he was in the nation. He was in the nation at the time. But when I talked to Malcolm, there were aspects of things that we could talk about. One aspect of him being in the nation at the time, coming there, he was this mythical person to so many of us in the movement. I certainly was part of the group of folks that respected him. I was playing lead role. Malcolm. We were in the group. We were organizing the meeting. People were coming into the. I talk about it in the book. I don't know. We came into the meeting, and the fruit of Islam, FOI, was saying to people, to the men, you sit here, the women, you sit over there, black people sit here, and within all of that, there are various separations. And people came to me and said, "This is Walter. What's happening here? This is not what we want." People in my movement, organization, and people who were part of the mass grouping that came to that, they were not. And I said, "Okay, to the FOI captain," and he said, "This is who we are. This is what we do." So I said to Malcolm X, "This is what's happening. This is this kid going up to Malcolm X. We had spent a lot of time together already, and saying to him, "This is happening, and this is contrary to who we are." Also, therefore, captain was saying, "This is who they are," and Malcolm said, "Okay, this is not going to happen." Told the captain and to not do that. Because they were like being the ushers and they were the organization in a sense. And he says, "This is what we're supposed to do." And Malcolm says to him, "I'm in charge here." And this is in their house. We come to them and we're going to work with them. And that's who he was. He was able to recognize, read the audience, read the people he was part of, read the movement. And I think that's what he did. Internationally, he read the movement and the movement of people, and decided for various reasons he had to move out of the nation and play a role in a different way. And because of that, he became even more dangerous to the world. But that's the kind of person that he was at that event when we talked and had a debate.
And it exemplifies a theme throughout the book, which is, how do we deal with the far too often cannibalization that can exist in some of our movement spaces where we're arguing over shades of blue and shades of gray versus really kind of like you're saying, people with different philosophies, ultimately a goal to uplift our community, but not get caught up in, something that could be divisive and leave everybody stagnant. But like, look, let's have this discussion if
Right.
y'all need, what I mean? So talk a little bit about that, because I think you talk consistently throughout the book about, these types of divisive things that show up and how that's something that you have always resisted from, and talk about the importance of listening and, as you said, reading the room and avoiding getting into conflicts around personality and really focused on what's at hand.
I agree. That's been part of what I've been as an organizer in the civil rights movement, field secretary for CORE, and organizing since that time, both in Progressive Labor Party. I am no longer in Progressive Labor Party. I left Progressive Labor Party in the 70s, by the way. But I still do community organizing around the concept of class struggle, the need and understanding of the primacy of Black folk to play a major role in leading and organizing because of our experiences and our relationship to power and economics. What we've experienced a lot in the history of our struggles is this kind of divisiveness. Political groups and political parties and individuals want to be very important. A lot of what we see in the movement right now is individuals wanting to be important. A lot of what happens is media likes to promote individuals, and there are whole kinds of understanding of why that works in our society, the sociological reasons why individuals become important in maintaining oppression, repression, the political elitist system that we have right now that leads to a lot of our problems and inability. And people buy into it. People bought into it in the civil rights era. People bought into it yesterday. So I think that what we will do is hopefully engage in greater discussions about how we can do something better. We have masses of people moving today, but masses of people moving in separate directions. We can see that in Oakland in terms of what happens when we go to City Hall. We can see it when we do in petitioning campaigns. We see it happening when we're doing election work, which becomes very important to figure out how we do that and who we do it with. We see it in the demonstrations, the differences between the individual leadership group and the masses of folks who are struggling. There's so many parts of that discussion that has to take place, and I'm grateful to Jesse for deciding to put together this discussion because of his experience, and I'm grateful to whatever media folks we can get involved in and help him to raise this. A lot to be done. I realize that my experience is something that there can be lessons from.
No,
I
there's a ton of lessons in the book to learn from, and I think it's important. I mean, I have a million more questions. I know we don't have time, but let me do this. Jesse, have put on your movement hat for a minute, and your radio hat for another second. So, what chapters stood out to you? Like as you were interviewing Walter and putting this together, he's like, damn, people gotta read this. Once they read this, what really, warmed your cackles, if I could use that old phrase,
Well, thank you, Davey. I am going to respond directly to that question, but I think the thing that's been on my mind for a while now is as I've been listening to your and Walter's conversation, earlier in this conversation, Walter told us that he was surprised that I approached him for this book project. And anyone that's been aware of Walter's work in Oakland during my lifetime or for a long time before that wouldn't be surprised at all. There's been people trying to convince Walter to write a book forever. So I'm super honored that he responded and we got to have these conversations. I certainly learned a lot, but I think a big portion of the reason that he had that feeling that I'm sure was genuine of surprise when I approached him is because he really thinks about this question of leadership that you all were discussing earlier in a deep and powerful way, where it's really about taking action and participating. And I learned so much in these conversations about Walter's approach to prioritizing not putting himself or not putting any specific leaders at the center of the work, that actually putting specific leaders at the center of the work is a distraction. And we see that throughout the book, throughout his stories, where class struggle is a portion of is the centerpiece of his political efforts and political leadership from early days in the civil rights movement. But even like, and he would never bring this up in the beginning of a conversation. So I'm gonna take care of that on his behalf. In the early days of the Black Panther Party, the Black Panthers were focused on this concept of Black power. Super important. We've been studying that and learning about it for so long. Walter was never a formal member of the Black Panther Party, but he was in the same milieus and working with the same people who were early in the Black Panther parties. And in those discussions, he brought up this conversation of class struggle, and he was part of the discussion that led to the creation of the phrase that we all know, all power to the people, because all power to the people brings in that class element in addition to the black power element. This has been like a portion of Walter's leadership approach. Whereas, and I like to call it leadership and not just leader. But let's be real, Walter has been a movement leader. I think that his ability to participate and not focus on one specific era or one specific contribution has been grounded in this approach to leadership. So that said, you asked me about a specific chapter, and every one of these chapters, I learned a lot. I think that the two that I'm thinking about right now in particular are the chapter on nonprofit imperialism and the alternate model he worked on creating with the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. Specifically thinking in the way Walter phrased it, when we're thinking about structural adjustment policies and ways that the global economy and the powerful countries impose political constraints on poor countries, and of course, his work there is particularly in Haiti. It's so simple in his comparison to how the nonprofit model has imposed constraints on movement building in communities. I'm not going to get too deep into that right now because we don't have time, but I will encourage folks to
Well,
read the book.
they can re read the book. It's
Exactly,
there.
exactly. But I also wanted to mention, the last chapter that Walter and I included in the book, which is called Movement Capture and Oakland Since Oscar Grant. Of course, it was powerful for me to learn about Walter's more historical role, but I met Walter in 2010. And I met Walter in the heat of that uprising in response to the police killing of Oscar Grant. And I've been organizing off and on in spaces with Walter since then. And so being able, having the opportunity to spend that time reflecting on, like before that in the book, it's like I want to grasp the concepts and I want to grasp the history that Walter's been involved with. But in that last chapter, it's really about something that we were able to collaborate and engage with. And I have the same historical memory of that timeline with Walter. So it's a unique opportunity to reflect. And so again, I'm not going to give too many spoilers. You got to read the book, but those are the two I'm thinking of highlighting.
Well, Jesse, job well done, and appreciate you for, taking that initiative and reminding us that we shouldn't just sit around and wait. The Bay's ethos is to do it yourself, So I'm glad you did that, and thank you, Walter. As we close out, anything that you want to leave us with, or did you have? Working with Jesse, an illuminating chapter for yourself where you're like, man, I'm glad we were able to really talk about that.
Well, I think I think of the book as a whole, that it gives an opportunity for some aspects of discussions that are not necessarily occurring. So, not in particular chapter, but the idea of Black liberation, the idea of national liberation, the ideas that come with class struggle in this country, and what roles we have to play. Have to be understood a lot more, and there are unique experiences that all of us have that we should bring to that and get rid of our egos in the process. That's what I'm hoping develops in whatever small way it can out of these discussions. And
Walter Riley. Yeah, go ahead, Jesse.
I want to add that, this book, it is a collection of Walter's stories. But it, moreover, it's a collection of Walter's lessons. Like, I want to be clear, this book is not a memoir. It is a conversation. It's a specifically and intentionally an intergenerational conversation. And the purpose of that, I love learning those very grounded stories and graphic things, including things you referred to, like the day he spent with Malcolm X, or like his experience with his father confronting the sheriff. While armed, and there's, those are still all in Durham. There's plenty of those stories throughout his life. But moreover, the purpose of this book is to build political lessons over that time, and to gather and glean some of those lessons from Walter's life in order to challenge people to reflect on our own pathways and roles within the movement. This book is not a historical document, even though there are historical moments documented there. The purpose behind this book is to lay out a challenge. How do we build from these lessons and really continue movement culture and build toward, the goal? The goal is to
But
win.
since it is a conversation, it ain't preachy. And because those stories are there, it's conversational and it's engaging and it's entertaining and, and all these things that I think are important if you really want to learn. If I can put on my professor hat for a minute, you just can't lecture to people. You have to really engage them. And I think y'all did a good job. So, Walter Riley, appreciate you. Jesse Strauss, thank you. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio.
Thank
We'll be
you.
right back.